The Curbsiders Teach podcast is for entertainment, education, and information purposes only, and the topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any diseases or conditions.
Furthermore, the views and statements expressed on this podcast are solely those of the speakers and should not be interpreted to reflect the official policy or position of any entity. You should always do your homework and give us any feedback.
Welcome back to the Curbsiders Teach Season 5, the podcast for health professions educators. I'm Dr. Molly Hoyblein, joined by my co-host, Dr. Ira Krishnovskaya. On today's episode, we'll discuss teaching with an anti-deficit framework with Siobhan Onuma, MD, MPH, MED. Before we get started with that, Ira, will you remind the audience what we do on this show?
You got it, Molly. We are the health professions podcast for all things education. We use expert interviews to bring you teaching pearls and practice-changing knowledge to inspire the next generation of clinician educators. And we have a great conversation with our guest, Dr. Siobhan Onuma. We cover shifting from a deficit to an anti-deficit framework in your teaching and your systems thinking, and really how to incorporate that anti-deficit approach into your everyday practice as an educator, as well as kind of our broader healthcare infrastructure.
And Dr. Siobhan Onuma, MD, MPH, MED, FACP, is a board-certified internal medicine, HIV specialist, and medical educator with formal training and expertise in curriculum development and innovation. Dr. Onuma is a proud HBCU alum hailing from Xavier University of Louisiana, earning a combined MD, MPH degree at Tulane University, and completed internal medicine residency training in the Global Medicine Pathway at the University of Minnesota. She completed an HIV clinical fellowship with the HIV Medical Association and Infectious Diseases Society of America and joined the GW faculty in 2011. Dr. Onuma later earned a Master of Education at George Washington University School of Education and Human Development. She is passionate about advancing health equity, supporting learner growth and development, and enhancing educational quality and equity through teaching and assessment strategies that enable all learners to reach their full potential.
Wow. And what an amazing episode we have to come. We're excited to bring you this season of Curbsiders Teach with the support of and in partnership with the Alliance for Academic Internal Medicine. And a reminder that most episodes are available for CME credit through VCU Health CE for all health professionals at curbsiders.vcuhealth.org. Thank you to all our Patreon members. If you love the Curbsiders family content and haven't yet joined, please consider supporting us and continuing to create this amazing resource. So without further ado,
let's get to it. Well, Dr. Onuma, thank you so much for joining us today. Do you mind if we call you Siobhan for this recording?
No problem.
Wonderful. Well, we like to just ask a few simple questions to help our listeners get to know our guests a little bit better. Could you give us a one-liner to describe yourself and maybe include something from outside of medicine?
Sure. I'm a 45-year-old internist and HIV specialist, mother of two sons, married to the love of my life, equity advocate, lover of Peloton and books and travel and food and music. Okay, a lot of loves.
Siobhan, I have a weakness for the Peloton app specifically. I don't actually have the Peloton anymore. We split it with one of my friends. But do you have a favorite person on the Peloton app that you like for Pelotoning, yoga, meditation, anything?
Oh my goodness, yes. If they're rides, my favorite is Tunde.
Yes.
She really gets me going. Strength training, Jess Sims, keeps me strong, I guess. And then I love Chelsea and Aditi for yoga. Those are kind of my favorites. But I try all of them. I think they're just phenomenal and talented group of folks.
That's amazing. We are not paid by Peloton, but this is a plug that the Peloton app is amazing, even for folks who just want to get the app and don't need to use the bike. I second all of Siobhan's recommendations.
And sounds like you've got a great workout routine between the strength training and the cardio and the stretching and yoga. That's excellent.
Interns, I have to practice what I preach. So
exactly. Yeah.
Yes.
I'm still working on that part. But since you mentioned that you're a book lover, do you have a recent book that you'd recommend? Or if you want to go real big, say a book that you would recommend that all health professions, clinicians read?
Let's see. Well, the book I recently just read was Harlem Rhapsody. It's part of my book club, but it was a really great book about like the Harlem Renaissance and authors. So it was a historical fiction, which I love. So told a really interesting story about a kind of unsung hero, I would say, in the literary world, along with W.E.B. Du Bois and a number of other folks. So I enjoyed that. I would say a book that everyone in medicine should read. I mean, how much time do I have? Medical Apartheid, I think, is required reading for sure. Mm-hmm. And even more recently, from a medical educator standpoint, I got this one from the Alliance of Academic Internal Medicine. One of our plenaries had recommended Coddling of the American Mind. It really, I think, from a just a parenting standpoint, as well as adult learners, and really kind of thinking about how we've transitioned our approach in raising children and adults, and how that is really impacting how, you know, they're approaching the world. And I think, you know, some of the things that we'll get into in this episode, too.
That sounds super interesting. Are you going to be joining us in New Orleans next week?
I will.
Amazing. This episode will actually come out probably next month or something. So after this will have already happened, but looking forward to seeing you there. Yeah. Hopefully we can meet up in person.
We'd love to see you in person, Siobhan. We should work on that afterwards.
Awesome.
Yeah.
I love it.
One other question we ask folks, kind of just introduction, is if you could share, Siobhan, some meaningful maybe advice or feedback that you received during your career or during training, even, and kind of the impact on you.
Yes. You know, I will say this advice is, you know, you get so much really meaningful advice. But as I think about kind of where we're at right now in the state of healthcare and, you know, I'm in D.C. and all the strain and everything that's going on here.
Yeah.
Probably one of the best pieces of advice I got was from a program director. I went to school in New Orleans, and it was kind of post Hurricane Katrina, and they described your emotional battery and really paying attention to, you know, I think I use this with my learners now. You think of your phone, you never, well, most of us don't like to get our phone down to you know, red.
Yes.
And so you really have to think about that as far as your emotional battery. And as you know, you're dealing with sick patients, or, you know, things are going on in your family life or a societal thing or international, lots of events and circumstances that are impacting you, and they take their drain. And we enter this profession, and it can be very draining and rewarding at the same time. And if we are not careful, we can allow our battery to drain, right? And so really being intentional and recharging and not allowing that your battery to go on E or the alert or I think that's probably been one of the best pieces of advice, and something that I definitely talk about with my own learners.
How do you recharge your emotional battery, Siobhan? Are there things that you do besides Peloton, of course?
Yes, yes. I'm a big meditator. I love spending time outdoors, spending time with family and friends. I actually just came back from a phenomenal girls trip in Charleston with my college friends. So, you know, we've been taking these trips for about 20 years or so, and meet up once a year. And that is just so refreshing and restorative as well. Mm-hmm. So, a combination of things. And you know, it's great to have friends that remind you. I have a great friend who's a psychiatrist, by the way, but she was talking to us and she said, you know, when you think about how many hours of the day that you're awake, you have to think about how much time do you actually spend with self-care and, you know, essentially making sure your battery is recharged. And if we are giving ourselves like 10, 20 minutes of that, you know, maybe 16 or more hours that we're awake, we're really shortchanging ourselves. So Anyhow, so I really try to be intentional about incorporating, some of that restorative practice on a daily basis, too.
I think that's huge. And I feel like you are a perfect plant for Iris Pick of the Week. The hosts like to sometimes give picks of the week, and Iris was right up this direction.
I know, Siobhan, what a transition. We did not plan it for all the listeners out there. But yes, Molly, my pick of the week is the Mindful Healers podcast, which is done by Jesse Mahoney, who's a graduate of Dartmouth and UCSF School of Medicine. She's a board-certified pediatrician, kind of physician wellness expert, teaches mindfulness, yoga, and then has this podcast. And the episode that kind of came across my, I guess, podcast journey was the How to Protect Your Peace When Healthcare Feels Under Siege. And she and the guest, who I'm forgetting the name of right now, kind of go through the emotional toll of practicing medicine in a healthcare system that often feels like it's working against us, and potentially a, national system that may be not as welcoming right now to science and healthcare, and kind of going through, like, how can we practice, resilience, emotional regulation, setting boundaries without feeling guilty about it, advocating for change without depleting ourselves. So kind of to the emotional battery that you were just talking about, Siobhan. So they also introduced me to a new concept called perpetual creative response, which basically helps you navigate uncertainty with curiosity instead of fear, which, I was really inspired by and felt like it was a great moment for me when things feel like they're attacking that inner peace that we have. So that's my pick of the week, Mindful Healers podcast, specifically episode 246, How to Protect Your Peace When Healthcare Feels Under Siege. Molly, what's your pick of the week?
Yeah, I'm going to recommend a book that I recently listened to. It's called There Are Rivers in the Sky by Elif Shafak. I'm sorry if I'm saying that wrong, but it was a really interesting book that follows multiple time periods and weaves the stories together, linking them all with water and sort of the life cycle of water, and sort of this idea that a drop of water continues the same throughout history and sort of who it's touched throughout the time. And so it talks about this ancient Nivean civilization that was back before concurrent with the Egyptians, and a woman in modern day Britain, and then like in the 1800s, a young boy in Europe as well who learned how to translate the Nivean script. And it was just like a really interesting weaving of cultures and history, and also some environmentalism and water shortages, and just an interesting all-around book.
Well, yeah. Thank you both. I mean, yeah. You're adding to my list here, my growing of things to listen to and read.
Amazing. Well, let's jump into our case here. We have a case from Cashlack Memorial. Maya is a first-generation medical student who lives in a rural community. During her undergraduate years, she worked part-time in customer service to support her family. Additionally, she worked at a nonprofit in her community that focused on mentoring and tutoring youth in low-income schools. Maya worked hard and has excelled in her undergraduate studies and is currently completing her clinical rotations in med school. Maya meets with her mentor in her desired specialty of pediatrics. The mentor mentions that the programs Maya is interested in might not be the best fit for her, as they have low rates of students coming from rural and low-income communities. They ask why Maya does not have more research experience or publications, and point out that her standardized test scores are lower than those of her peers. They suggest that she sign up for some tutoring to improve her academic performance. So I think to get us started, let's ground ourselves in some definitions. Siobhan, could you share more about the term anti-deficit, and how does that word lend itself to a framework? And what are kind of the origins of the concept of anti-deficit approaches?
Yes, thank you. Anti-deficit is a framework, if you will, where you are, instead of focusing on the learner, we'll talk about learners, instead of focusing on their shortcomings or failures, you actually are reframing it and thinking about what strengths, what assets they actually bring to the table that actually may have come from whatever experiences or setbacks that they may have had. And this is particularly come into play when we think about people from marginalized communities or historically underrepresented groups that we know are often perceived to have shortcomings and failures, even if they don't in fact have those.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Siobhan, that's super helpful because I think, you know, for maybe health professions education, anti-deficit or anti-deficit frameworks might actually be really new and really kind of, transformational, but essentially transformational because the traditional model, it sounds like you're saying, you know, has really focused on those shortcomings that maybe people might have or maybe perceive to have, right? Which I really appreciate you clarifying that there's a perception involved in that. I wonder, with the case that Molly shared, were there particular aspects of Maya's history, background, kind of experiences in medical school that might be traditionally considered like deficits, and maybe kind of what has contributed to those things being deficits before we obviously get into kind of a different approach, the anti-deficit approach?
Yeah, absolutely. I thinking about as you described Maya as a first generation medical student. And so first off, maybe not having the network, if you will, or knowledge of how to navigate medical school. And even growing up, you know, when we think about geography, even growing up in a rural area, that may be a perceived deficit depending on where she's training or what have you. Her experience working in customer service, maybe not following a traditional pathway and volunteering at hospitals or working doing research, medical research or things of that nature. So that could be seen as a deficit. So these things that are happening even before she gets into medical school. You know, I would say the other piece that you described was she doesn't have much in the way of research experiences or publications. So those are kind of more current, but looking at, you know, her resume, if you will, and maybe comparing her to others at this level. And the standardized test scores were lower than those of her peers was another element where people may see that as a deficit.
Yeah, I think those are the main ones. And, you know, obviously we made the case a little heavy on the deficit side, but I think this is something that happens frequently in health professions education, that we do sometimes get overly focused on, you know, this isn't going well, let's focus on this to try to improve it, rather than looking at the big picture of what are the skills that and the strengths that this person is bringing. Why do you think that this has been perpetuated so much in medical education? Aspects of research or terminology or assessment that really help or not help, but continue to perpetuate more of a deficit approach?
Yeah, I think, you know, part of it is we are a very traditional and that's medicine. If you compare us as we, you know, you already alluded to about the anti-deficit approach is something that we've seen and it's been studied and talked about and written about in psychology and other sectors. And medicine, we tend to be a little bit behind the curve and very traditional. And I think, you know, we sometimes get very stuck in like there's a formula. This is what success looks like. And it's hard to kind of undo and unlearn some of those habits. So I think that's part of the reason. And so we need to, you know, shake things up and ask ourselves, you know, is this really what success looks like? And I think a number of our, you know, accrediting bodies, if you will, have started doing that. And when you think about from, you know, the ACGME, for instance, I'm a program director, and we look at the competencies, right? And there's multiple competencies. You have patient care and medical knowledge and systems-based practice and, you know, interpersonal skills. And you have all of these competencies, professionalism, because we know that a physician that is competent and thriving actually needs to have all of these skills, right? Mm-hmm. And so when we think about Maya, for instance, and you know, maybe
talk about the standardized test scores and the inherent bias in that a little bit later. But if we think about, you know, standardized test scores as maybe one measure of a surrogate measure of what someone may perceive a medical knowledge to be, does that tell the full story? Does that tell the full story in how Maya actually will interact with patients, how she's able to apply knowledge, what her interpersonal skills are? And I would argue that all of those skills are really important. One quote that my learners know I love to say is that, you know, no one really cares how much you know until they know how much you care. So,
totally.
You know, we can have someone that scores, let's say, you know, I don't know how high we go now on the not the MCAT, but the boards, 270.
Yeah.
You know, they get the 270 on the boards, but they're not actually able to connect with that patient and to explain things in a way in which the patient is able to understand or actually take that advice. I don't know how successful they actually will be in, you know, improving the lives and the health of the patients that they're serving. So so that's just, you know, one example.
Can I ask, Siobhan, just thinking about your role, you know, you mentioned being a program director and thinking about the competencies holistically and kind of how we also potentially maybe give trainees kind of a sense of how they're doing along those competencies. Have you noticed a shift? I know this is getting away from Maya's case, but have you noticed a shift from how even competencies are created / evaluated for trainees relative to movement from a deficit to an anti-deficit framework? Or is the traditional aspect of medicine, which is so powerful and so entrenched, just like still there saying like, how are you not meeting or not enough on these competency levels?
Yeah, I do think that there has been a movement towards, you know, kind of more holistic review of a learner and their skill set. And I think especially once we are really intentional and considering, you know, if you reflect back on people, you know, your learners that really made a lasting impression, and, you know, whether that was, you know, as an individual case-by-case basis with patient care, or whether that was, you know, being a role model for the program, you'll often find it wasn't just the person that was able to spit off all the facts, right?
Yeah.
They were the ones that stood out because they were able to, you know, collaborate with interprofessional team members, right? Or you may have seen patient advocacy skills that really, you know, were a step ahead of others, which, you know, a lot of these skills are things that they're a little bit harder to test, if you will, or assess by a standardized test, right? Mm-hmm. So that's what I mean by that standardized test is telling, you know, one part of the puzzle, and that has its own, you know, and here we know data showing the biases that are there and how disparities in scores for standardized tests that do not predict how the learners are actually going to perform. I don't know about you all, but I cannot even actually remember what I got on the boards. But I can tell you my patients don't seem to ask that either. Yeah, patients that have been following me for decades and are very pleased with my care. And I think that at the end of the day is what we want. People that are, you know, competent and able to really deliver care, you know, safe, effective, and equitable care.
And you mentioned this a little bit already, and specifically with the example of the standardized testing. How do you see the deficit model playing into continuing sustaining systemic inequalities?
Yeah, well, if you think about the deficit model and how it's oftentimes what we're doing with the deficit model is, like in Maya's case, wondering, you know, what is wrong with them? Why don't they have enough publications, or why are they not able to score higher on this exam? or why are their evaluations? Why are their evaluations aren't higher? And where you're not actually looking at the what are the systemic factors that are playing a role? So, you know, we already talked about the exams, if you will, but let's talk about her lack thereof of publications and research. She's supporting her family or has been working with supporting her family, also doing some work in tutoring and service and things that are important and meaningful to her. And so if you're just comparing those, you know, tangible metrics, if you will, of publications and research, but are we really looking at what is the skill that we hope? Like what is, you know, publications or research, what is that a measure of? Usually, you know, you're looking at someone that can think creatively or collaboratively, follow a project through. I would argue that working in low-income neighborhoods or tutoring and longitudinal project that Maya is involved in is actually showing some very similar skills, right? Being able to work while in school, you know, also if we think about reframing it from an asset approach, shows her ability to, you know, multitask and to prioritize. So I think what we really need to do is, you know, really make sure we're thinking about the measures, the traditional measures that are ingrained and that are continuing to kind of widen the gap and have these, you know, perpetuate these systemic inequities and identify like what was that measure there for in the first place? And are there other ways that we can, you know, look at a learner and determine, do they have the qualities and characteristics that lend them to be successful in medicine?
Totally. It's like the meta reframe, Siobhan, is what I'm hearing. Like, it's almost like we need to take a step back to all the ways that we have framed admissions, all the ways we've framed, I don't know, success in medical school, success in undergraduate, success in residency or in training programs in general for health professions learners. It's kind of like asking us to take a step back and being like, how do we really think about this differently? And to do that, we have the second half of Maya's case, which basically has her starting her sub-I in pediatrics at a large urban academic medical center. And during her time on service, she's building rapport with patients. She's the only person on the team who is a certified bilingual interpreter, enables her to offer counseling around community resources for patients from rural areas. And then during rounds, she's observed to be an active listener, clear communicator with patients. She demonstrates her ability to remain patient and calm, even in challenging patient scenarios. And Maya's attending takes note of all these moments and commends her for the advocacy, the patient education, the patient-centered communication. And in fact, later in the rotation, that same attending notices Maya helping explain concepts to a new student on rounds and coaching them to write an HMP. And when Maya shares that she's interested in continuing kind of this near-peer teaching and mentorship skills in med school, the faculty member specifically connects her with an opportunity to participate in a near-peer tutoring program for third-year medical students. So I know that was kind of a lot that Maya is doing and being noticed for. And maybe you could highlight for us specifically kind of aspects of that case that really showcase how this faculty is really approaching the situation from an anti-deficit perspective or lens.
Yeah, I just wanted to really, you know, shout out that faculty member. I thought they did a phenomenal job. But as you mentioned, I think highlighting Maya's working as a certified bilingual medical interpreter, being multilingual in today's society is certainly an asset. Totally. And to be certified in particular, it shows one that she is committed to kind of reducing language inequities and has you know, actually taking the initiative to become certified so that she can do this in a way that is helping to bridge that gap for these patients. And so the other piece I would say that the attending highlighted for sure was just her clear communication outside of the language piece, right? We were alluding to, or I was alluding to earlier, is that if you are really, if what I consider to be successful in patient care is our outcomes, right? So again, yes, I certainly can learn all the studies there are to know. I mean, now with open evidence and all of the things at your fingertips, I don't know how much I need to remember all of these very specific studies and treatment plans. But what I do need to know is how to communicate, whether it's the disease process and making sure that patients understand what is going on and why we need to consider a different approach, whether it's diagnostic or therapeutic plan. I do need to be able to anticipate what barriers or potential, you know, hesitation that they may have and maybe reframe my approach. I think those are, you know, kind of key elements in what I would measure as success if we're looking at outcomes, if our focus is to ensure that we're improving patient outcomes, at least to the best of our ability. Of course, we also know patients get to make decisions, so we're not 100% in control there. But doing our part. I think the other piece that the attending highlighted was this peer education piece, right? And so when you have learners that are bringing their authentic selves to the table and they have, you know, experiences that have shaped them, and then they're able to share what they learned, their experience, their wisdom with others, you in turn have now enhanced the learning for those that did not have those experiences, right? And so, you know, really highlighting that she's an asset as a peer educator, I think was another way the attending really reframed this for with an anti-deficit lens.
I love your focus on bringing it back to sort of what are we trying to do with our trainees, which is hopefully to create doctors who reflect their communities that they're going to be serving in, that can really relate to the communities that they're serving in and actually provide good patient care for the majority of the time. I mean, of course, there are MD PhDs who need to be excellent at research, but for the majority of us, you know, being able to get an A in college physics probably does not impact my ability to be a successful primary care doctor. I think, you know, you've already highlighted some of this, and I can just imagining what Maya would feel after the first conversation versus after the second conversation. Clearly, there are many benefits to the anti-deficit framework, but could you share how switching from the deficit to anti-deficit model can have broader implications on creating more supportive and equitable learning environments?
Yeah, absolutely. When you think about, I really just have to honor Lucy and colleagues in there, the way they have framed educational equity and kind of the three components. And we talk about contextual equity and instrumental equity and intrinsic equity. And when you think about contextual equity, what they describe is like the environment and the hidden curriculum in which the learners are learning and being assessed to. And so when you are, you know, allowing Maya to, show up as her authentic self and highlight the assets that she is, you are, you know, kind of, one, creating a space, a psychologically safe space, right? Which is really important for that contextual equity. And I think the other piece is we know that there are, you know, not just people of marginalized groups, but even more so people from marginalized groups and historically underrepresented groups sometimes deal with imposter syndrome, right? Mm. And stereotype threat. And so, you know, stereotype threat is when you know that stereotypes exist for a population or identity that you may identify with, and you feel the pressure to have to try to counteract against that threat, but it puts so much pressure on you that maybe your performance is hindered. Mm-hmm. However, when you use an anti-deficit framework and your attending or, you know, supervisor is using that framework and they're actually highlighting the things that, you know, you bring to the table, the qualities that you bring to the table, you are less likely to feel like, and I can just even talk from my own experience, less likely to feel like I have something to prove other than just being myself and what qualities that I have inherently from my experiences, all of the, you know, assets and ways that I contribute positively to the team, to the learning environment. So I think, you know, that is probably one of the biggest pieces, is that it actually empowers that learner, right? And takes away some of that strain that we deal with, especially when you tend to be, you know, maybe a minority in the group, or your path to medicine was different than a number of your colleagues.
Totally. And Siobhan, I was just thinking, and you kind of mentioned this already, that switching for educators who are hopefully our audience everywhere, you know, from a learner as educator to faculty as educator, everyone, patients as educators, it sounds like switching from a deficit lens to an anti-deficit lens really allows educators to highlight those qualities, like you said, and ensure that the learner doesn't feel like they have something to prove, not to mention kind of addressing some of the institutional contextual issues around equity. Is there anything else that we've missed that kind of, you know, we can share with other educators? Like, when you do this, when you embody this anti-deficit approach, it really does impact your learners, promote success, promote kind of the, honestly, the way that the system works and improves patient care. Is there something that we've, you know, maybe haven't mentioned yet around that you wanted to?
Yeah, I think a huge piece, and this is, you know, hopefully, I feel like we're moving in this direction and have been in medical education, but really focusing on kind of that growth mindset. You know, we hadn't talked as much about the terminology, but some of the deficit focused terminology that we tend to use, like, oh, this learner is at risk, or you know, there are certain terms that we label people with, right? And it's very fixed. Honestly, I mean, any learner is at risk if we don't provide them with the right supports and they don't, you know, do the things that they also can do to ensure that they are growing and developing. And all learners have opportunities, right? And so I think when we use those terms, it becomes very fixed and can hinder growth and development. So I think it's really important to, you know, approach all of our learners with, and even framing that when they're coming into a new situation or learning environment, that, hey, everyone has an opportunity here for growth. We're all going to be coming at different levels. I am going to be intentional about giving each person their feedback. And that's how we're going to grow. And so you normalize the feedback, you normalize that we have opportunities and that we're approaching this with, and we want them to approach, most importantly, with, you know, a growth mindset. You know, the fixed at risk, I think, can be very, very, you know, detrimental when we label learners like that. I mean, it also biases us too. I'll just give a brief example that there was when I was a former clerkship director, so I had a clerkship student, and we had a, you know, grading committee, and there were comments about a particular learner being at risk, and, you know, there were concerns, and then trickled on to when it was time for match and this learner wanted to, you know, come to our program. And, you know, there were these concerns. And then, but not everyone, you know, I think folks that had directly observed this learner thought otherwise. And so the learner ended up matching with us. And do you know that learner excelled and thrived and ended up being one of our top residents, went on to be a chief, went on to do a fellowship in a very competitive specialty and, you know, a prestigious institution and all of the things that, you know, I think if we held on to that label of that learner early on and also approached that learner with that deficit language and terminology, could have really derailed their career, honestly. So so that's just one example in how I think, you know, really being intentional about learners. It's a fluid process, right? And so there, no one stays in one state. And so just taking that terminology out of our vocabulary, I think, would be helpful.
Thank you for highlighting that. I think that that's a great example. And you kind of mentioned, as an individual educator, sort of normalizing feedback, setting the tone for the team that, you know, this is going to be a frequent thing. You also mentioned really supporting learners in being their authentic selves and allowing them to feel supported in that. Do you have some other specific tips of how an individual educator can incorporate kind of learning and celebrating the identities and experiences of their team members into busy days? Especially even if you're just working with a learner for maybe a one-off session, a half day at a time.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I will say I've been really fortunate to work with some amazing colleagues through the Alliance of Academic Internal Medicine. And we had spent some time really thinking about, you know, how do we promote equity in the learning environment as well as assessment, and had an opportunity to do a really deep dive into this and looking at the literature and what were best practices. And, you know, I'm fortunate to have, you know, folks like Dr. Aryan Tarani and Dr. Karen Hauer and others, you know, many that have kind of done this. And so we actually in academic medicine have a, interestingly, case. I know you didn't necessarily look at that article for this case, but we have a case-based approach where we have a learner, and we use the case because I think it's helpful to, you know, apply this in the real setting or, you know, like a real life setting. Mm-hmm. And basically we, using that case, think about each step of the learning environment, how we evaluate learners and, you know, feedback and all of those pieces, and really gave some very detailed strategies as well as resources and how individual educators could promote. And we didn't necessarily, the article wasn't focused on a anti-deficit lens, if you will. It was more focused on, again, the contextual, intrinsic, and instrumental equity piece, but I honestly, those are the same tools. So thinking about, for instance, the one way to promote psychological safety is actually getting to know your learners. I can tell you how learners say the simple things in ensuring that we know their names and how to pronounce their names or what their preferred pronoun may be. Those are things that, you know, welcome the learner. They feel that they can maybe show up as their authentic self, getting to know them. It only takes, honestly, a couple of minutes to get to know them. I actually got some great tools from Dr. Manning and group several years ago. And they just basically like little icebreaker tools that also tells you a little bit more about the learner. So one I use every time I start a WARS team is we, you know, share where we consider home to be, and then a food that reminds you of home, right? Folks love sharing that. It tells us a little bit about them. You know, it may be, sometimes it's culturally, sometimes it's just, this is my favorite food, or my mom cooks this, or what have you. So we learn something about them that's important. But one, it creates this environment that I actually see you as a person too. And now that learner is, it's a little bit more invested. Okay, yes, they know they have a team that is assessing them and evaluating them, but they're a bit more invested in, or they know that you're invested, I should say, actually. They know that you're invested in learning about them as a person. So I think that that's, you know, those are a few tools. Other things for, you know, individual educators, I would say, are direct observation. I cannot stress that enough. When we just talked about the, you know, all the competencies, I have no idea how you could actually evaluate a learner on these multiple competencies
by
hearing them present the case. that is, you know, you may get a touch of some medical education. Mm-hmm. Perhaps you could say, okay, patient care, maybe a little systems-based practice, but you get my point, is that it mm-hmm. is really hard to truly assess. And if we're looking at that learner holistically and all of the components that are really going to ensure that they're going to be an effective physician, clinician, if that's what our goal is at the end of the day, then we really need to step out of the team room, mm-hmm. watch them interview, watch them examine people, observe them communicating with nursing or case managers, consultants, the patients and their families, of course, watch them counsel and see. I think that's what this faculty member was able to observe with Maya. So the direct observation is really important, and having multiple, you know, points of observation is also important too, right?
Totally. And Siobhan, you've given us so many things for like the individual educator to do, right? Whether it's a certain language, certain terminology, ways to start kind of the conversation and getting to know your learners, normalizing feedback probably as part of that conversation and introduction. I wonder, from a systems perspective, outside of what we've mentioned already, and you've kind of really beautifully told us about relative to holistic review, let's say, for admissions, are there other ways that maybe programs or institutions can incorporate an anti-deficit framework or lens into, you know, their systems and practices? Maybe it's promoting recruitment or retention of historically underrepresented learners or something else that you, you know, another way or another example you could share.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, just to echo what you said, I think when we have folks coming with all types of diverse experiences and can speak to why those experiences are assets, that is going to help our programs, right? And there's, you know, data that shows why, you know, homogeny is actually not helping anyone. So that's one. Faculty development is really important, and faculty development that, you know, focuses on one, bias mitigation. It's one thing to be aware that we all have bias, but then how do we mitigate? You know, mm-hmm. do we use evidence-based strategies, perspective taking, mindfulness strategies? You know, there's a lot of literature that shows what can be effective and how that can impact. I would also say that, you know, narrative assessment is a huge part. It's part of what we owe to the learners, right? Yeah. To ensure their growth. Because when I think about assessment, I think about assessment, yes, of learning, but also for learning, right? That is a part of learning. And so ensuring that we are training faculty to, you know, when they're writing the narrative about the learner, that they're actually thinking about the competency and using language that is telling the story of that person's, you know, skill set, right? And, you know, oftentimes, I'm sure you all have read some evaluations or letters that say, oh, this was a pleasant student. And, you know, they did a great job. And at the end of the day, I read the evaluation and I'm like, well, I don't really know what their skill set was really like.
Totally.
And so for even at our program, one thing that we have done is, you know, done some training, but also have a handout, if you will. And I keep it up myself too when I'm filling out evaluations, where I have all of the competencies or and what those skills are like. So, you know, for example, interpersonal communication as an area. And so you may want to think about what type of communication mm-hmm. what does that look like? And so having the terminology that really allows the evaluator, the assessor to describe that skill set and be realistic too. I mean, you know, and honest, everyone is not thriving in each category. So just giving them the language though, so that the feedback is honest, and that allows, that empowers the learner to be able to tailor their development as well. So I think the narrative assessment piece and having tools around that, training and tools to ensure that narratives are, you know, quality, they describe specific behaviors, and they're based on, again, the direct observation, I think is another key piece, right? So it's hard to describe the different subcompetencies or milestones without observing the learner in real time. And let's see if I might have more, but
I think those are great. And for faculty who are interested in learning more about this and improving their skills, do you have any specific resources? You mentioned that your paper in academic medicine, and we can certainly link to that. But any other modules or resources that you feel like are helpful for people who are trying to shift their approach and motivated to learn more about this?
Yeah, so absolutely. I will certainly plug that article. One thing is I'm a very like practical, love, you know, charts, if you will, or tables. And so I think that was really important for us to include a table for, you know, kind of each of those recommendations, so that you do have some tools and tips. When we think about like bias mitigation strategies, I think Dr. Christina Gonzalez has done some really great work and has a 12 tips paper, especially if you're thinking about programs and how what strategies have been effective for bias training. Mm-hmm. I would say, I probably one of the things that, especially while I was a clerkship director, that was really instrumental and helped us to, you know, kind of switch over some of our materials was the equity checklist at UCSF. Dr. Karen Hauer and I guess team over there have that posted and available for folks, which I think is just a great resource too. So I think these are nice practical strategies. Of course, there are a number of articles, and then they're linked, of course, in our article as well, that if people want to do kind of more in-depth, but these have some very practical tips and tools for you. We coming soon, not out currently, but I was able to work with, I was so fortunate to learn from and partner with Dr. Osmond and Dr. Howard on a book chapter for the Alliance of Clinical Education. And that's also going to have some practical tools and tips as well. Because that's what I think people want to. I believe that in medical education, we want to ensure that learners are succeeding. We want medicine to thrive, right?
Yeah.
And so, of course, we want our learners to thrive and be going to have successful careers and be impactful. And it's one of those things where we just have to be very intentional about, you know, getting the evidence out there. I think even at research, like reframing the research to ask the questions, not so much about what's the deficit or why there's a deficit, but like, let's identify people that are thriving and what are the characteristics and qualities and, you know, activities or strategies that have really enabled them to thrive. I think that that is where medicine is headed. And I know medical educators want to do this and want to do it right, but sometimes feel like they lack the tools and strategy. So hopefully, you know, some of these resources will be helpful and there'll be more to come.
Totally. And Siobhan, I do want to say, like, as we're, you know, this was amazing. And as you're thinking about, you know, take home points and kind of the things we really want to leave people with, which maybe that was it just now. One thing I am struck with is really the corollary between kind of this approach and how we, I would like to believe, deal with patient care and kind of act within patient care. Like, I do a lot of addiction medicine, and our goal was to really think about strengths-based kind of patient care and really focusing on what the individual in front of us has experienced, has, you know, aspects of resilience, these strengths, these kind of really positives. And I want to highlight for our audience that, like, you are doing this already in patient care. Like, the anti-deficit approach is what we hope, cross fingers and toes, that our clinicians are doing with patients, really, and emphasizing, wow, like, your congratulations on this. You've done this really well, like, all these positives. And really just trying to say, can we move the needle on doing this with learners and really kind of help educators kind of integrate all these incredible, you know, skills and tips that you're sharing in the book chapter and the articles and things, but recognizing that many people, if not hopefully most people, are doing this already. And it just, like, how can we, you know, apply those strategies for the clinical learning environment or the classroom, the learning environment in general. So that was my long monologue preamble to what are your take-home points, Siobhan, from this amazing time?
I love what you just said. I mean, I love that. And you're absolutely right. Applying the same concepts that we use on a day-to-day patient care, why not apply that in the medical education realm, right? Essentially, people, our learners, first of all, have made it this far. They have the skills, the tools to thrive, to be successful. And I really think for us as medical educators is to be able to tap into that. And at the same time, you know, I don't want us to swing the pendulum. And that's why I kind of mentioned the book earlier, Coddling book. We don't want to swing the pendulum and be so afraid to give honest feedback because we then hinder, right? Our learners need to know where their opportunities are, but they also need to know that they have a lot of assets and really strong contribution or bring strong contributions to medicine, to their patients. And I think that's really probably my take home is, you know, making sure we're really mindful about that. I guess I'll bring it back to your podcast that I'll have to listen to is, you know, really being mindful when we are with the learners, whether that's creating an environment to where they can, you know, actually bring their full selves and perform at their best. The being mindful when we're observing them, mindful with our assessment, mindful with our language. And I think that's how we, you know, support them and really promote this anti-deficit framework, because as we know, when we are non-intentional, we're going to revert back to what's been ingrained in the medical education system and really all of society. So, yeah, totally. That would be my take home.
Amazing. Thank you so much. Well, this has been a really fantastic discussion, and I think we'll give our listeners a lot to reflect on and hopefully improve their educator skills.
All right. Well, thank you all for having me. This has been fun, and hope to see you all in New Orleans. Yeah.
New Orleans.
Where we're going.
Yeah. Ira, do you have a your favorite take-home point of something you want to try to put into practice in the next week or two?
Oh my gosh, Molly, so many. I think one thing that Siobhan highlighted that I really would love to do is just kind of incorporate components of direct observation where I can truly highlight for learners kind of areas of success and areas of growth, and be really, really intentional that, like, we are highlighting qualities and things that, you know, let the learner feel like they're being their authentic self, and that, you know, a fixed approach really kind of hinders that type of growth. So just being, you know, maybe it's verbalizing it, but just being very intentional about, like, in this direct observation, this is what I'm seeing that is really something to continue that's been very successful and that you are doing. And also, I'm really focused on your growth and for us to continue to see you succeed and, you know, advocating for that growth edge, perhaps. What about you, Molly?
Yeah, I think it just was very inspiring overall to be mindful about this when I think about working with my learners and sharing feedback. This has been another episode of the Curbsiders Teach. Get your show notes at thecurbsiders.com/teach. A special thanks to the Alliance for Academic Internal Medicine for making this season possible, and to Dr. Matt Watto and Dr. Paul Williams for their support in this project. Thanks to Dr. Karishma Patel for helping with the script and show notes. Thanks to the team at Podpace for editing and production support. Until next time, I've been Dr. Molly Hoyblein.
And we're committed to providing you with high-value, practice-changing knowledge. And to do that, we need your feedback. So please subscribe, rate, and review the show on Apple Podcasts, or contact us at thecurbsidersteach@gmail.com. A reminder that this and most of episodes are available for CME credit for all healthcare professionals at curbsiders.vcuhealth.org. All you have to do is create an account. I'm Dr. Ira Krishnowska, and thank you so much for joining us today and letting us bring you a little nugget of medical edutainment.